and thanks for joining us on a special edition of Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Tonight, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations we've had this year. Here's what we're looking at. A historic life and career in politics. Former Senator from Illinois, Carol Moseley Braun, on her new memoir. Illinois is getting some new neighbors as armadillos are moving north. What you should know. How a group of young writers are breaking into the publishing world.
Run to the grocery store, make a trip to the hardware store. Buy a new car? Not so fast, not on Sunday.
And we explain why you can't buy a car in Illinois on Sunday. We kick things off right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Carol Moseley Braun is making waves in the push for more diverse leaders in politics. Her historic election in 1993 as the country's first black woman senator shuttled her into the national and cultural spotlight. From her stint in the Illinois General Assembly to serving as the ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa, Moseley Braun made a journey through the ranks, but not without some obstacles along the way. She reveals how she broke through barriers in her new memoir, Trailblazer. Perseverance in Life and Politics. Bless you. Joining us now is the book's author herself, Carol Moseley Braun. Ambassador, welcome back to Chicago Tonight.
Thank you. Voices. My pleasure to be here.
Congrats on the book. Of course, there have been decades of news coverage and books chronicling your historic rise in politics. Why did you want to tell your story this way?
People kept asking me, when are you going to write a book? This is my first, so it just made sense to do it now while I'm still here.
Are there other books in the works for you,
no,
do you think?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, unless there are questions with this one.
Unless there's questions with this one, and then you'll write a second one to clear that up. You open up in this book, of course, about your own personal struggles from finding out and dealing with dyslexia in law school, not a great time, to growing up under an abusive alcoholic father. Why share those struggles now?
Well, it was part of my story, part of my journey, actually. My dad... He wasn't alcoholic, but he was troubled.
Troubled.
And it was a difficult childhood, and I thought it was important to tell the truth about all of that.
Describe that childhood and how that impacted you, how that influenced you.
He would sometimes be very violent and beat me and my brothers and sisters, but primarily me because I was the oldest, right? And so, I'd survived that, and that's one of the reasons for the subtext of perseverance. You know, you survive being beat up as a child, you know, truly, clearly that leaves an impact on you for the rest of your life. But I came through that, and maybe that was the grounding for all the rest of the, you know, kicking around that I got as a politician.
because he was a musician, and you talk about, you know, him playing the piano, and there were certain tones or certain pieces that you would hear him play that would sort of, you know, foretell what you and your siblings knew what was coming.
He came, his family were family musicians. They came from New Orleans, and they played, he played 7 instruments and spoke 5 languages. So the man was, in one way, he was genius, but on the other hand, he beat his family.
He was troubled.
Yeah.
You say in your book that, you know, those challenges at one point, they, you know, they took a toll on your self-esteem and your confidence, you know, the dyslexia as well. How do you think you overcame all of that?
Perseverance, and that's the subtext of the book, subtitle of the book. And so you just take one foot in front of the other, and if you just keep doing what you think is right, and, you know, it'll come out fine.
From reading the book, it seems to me like that perseverance comes from the people who raised you, the ancestors who came before you.
That's right. My mother was a great influence. She'd say, do the best job you can where you're planted. And so that became a signal for me just to work hard at whatever it was that I was doing and try to do the best. And that was the best expression of who I was. And it made a difference.
You came of age during the civil rights movement, of course, got involved in some of that activism. What were some of the influences that shaped your involvement in social justice at a young age? You were even there that day at Marquette Park with Dr. King.
Right. You know, back to my dad, right? He was actually, because he was such a, he was a difficult man, but he had a very keen intellect. And among the things that he did was introduce me to the principles behind the labor union movement when I was coming up. So between support for labor, support for civil rights, and the other lessons that he imparted, there was no other choice for me but to be active.
Many people that you know for your, you know, decades-long work in politics, from the Illinois General Assembly to the Senate, that's how people remember you a lot. But you say in your book that your career in politics was actually accidental. How'd you get into it?
Well, there's two parts, actually. One was the bobolinks in Jackson Park. And I joined a protest because the park district was going to tear down some trees or tear down an area that had been populated by these little rice birds from South Carolina. And somewhere there's a picture of it. I haven't found it, but anyway, Park District Doe bobolinks, yes. So I was protesting, trying to protect the bobolinks, and that was one. But the second thing was that I had actually run for office before, unwittingly. I didn't know I was going to be my future path. But when I was in college, I was secretary of the Action Party, running for the student government leadership, and so I did that. I had no idea at the time that was a clue to where I was going to go with my career.
There'd be more running for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Later on, of course, you end up sort of struggling the balance of raising a family along with your dedication to public service, which is, of course, something that many working parents are familiar with. Do you think that there were often, though, different expectations for women and mothers in particular in public service?
Still are. Absolutely. It's funny, too, because when my son, Matt, who I adore, was little, he was asked, well, what did your mother do? His answer was, oh, she goes to meetings and parties.
Meetings and parties, because public service is just that easy.
So, but yeah, no, it was important to, back to my mother, do the best job you can when you're planted. Being a mother was important to me, and so I wanted to do the best job that I could with it.
How do you think you did that?
By accident. I have no idea. My son is magnificent. He is one. I hope he's watching this. He's in Canada right now.
We'll send him the link if not.
Yeah, no. He's wonderful, and he takes good care of me. And I just consider myself so blessed to have gotten this wonderful son and wonderful family in spite of myself. I tried, but I'm sure I fell short.
As the first black woman senator, you were often scrutinized for your appearance, for your personality. But you, of course, wanted to be known for the subject of your work, the service that you're there for. How did you navigate that scrutiny on Capitol Hill?
I didn't do very well. I didn't win re-election. But I think so long as I figured out all I could do was my job, and if I focused in on doing that, I'd be fine. And as it turned out, I was. I mean, I am. You know, I'm not crazy.
I mean, much. Was that scrutiny, was it ever hurtful?
A lot of times, yes, it was. But I don't dwell on that. That's part of perseverance. You kind of have to take that stuff and put it over there somewhere. And as Marge Simpson said, you just stamp on it until it goes away. You know, so, you know, you just kind of, you can't let the naysayers, and you can't let the negative things derail your effort, your path. And so, and I never did. I just kept focusing on where I was going.
It's good to take advice from Marge Simpson.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, as we mentioned, there were some bumps along the way. Of course, there was the Medicaid disclosure just before your election to the Senate, questions raised by your visits to Nigeria. There was reporting about high staff turnover when you were in your Senate office. How do you reflect on the mistakes you've made, the lessons you've learned, the criticism you received back then?
Well, I should have done a better job with my press relations, number one. I mean, that's kind of fundamental. I mean, that's pretty obvious because I did not do a very good job of communicating what I was doing, because I was focused on my job. I was focused on passing legislation. I was focused on being the best senator I could. And I think, you know, I think I succeeded at that. I passed most of the bills that I filed, and I represented my state. That was the whole job, because it's such a diverse, such a huge state with diverse, everything from Chicago to the little towns. Chicago to agriculture. You got everything in the state. And so I had to make sure that everybody got the attention that they deserved, that they needed, and that's what I tried to do.
I want to talk about today a little bit, because there are two black women who are running for U.S. Senate now. Representative...
I supported both of them.
Representative Robin Kelly and, of course, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. What would it mean to you if either one of them, you know, should end up winning and becoming the second black woman to represent Illinois?
Well, the good news is that it's the old, you're the first, but you don't want to be the last. So it would be wonderful if we could get a woman elected from Illinois, a black woman elected from this state. I'd be delighted.
What does it say that it will have been 20-plus years? I'm not mathing correctly. 30-plus years, yeah, since the first woman did it. Since you did it.
You know, it says that sexism is sometimes harder to overcome than racism, even. And I don't know why that's so. It's historical. I mean, I could sit here for hours and...
We could.
Forth. Yeah, don't worry about doing that. But the fact of the matter is that the idea of electing a woman is harder for some people than the idea of electing a black person or a person of color. And why that's so, it's historical and social and cultural, et cetera. Okay. But I think it would be a good thing for our state.
Right. Ambassador Carol Mosley Braun, congrats on the book. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, the book is called Trailblazer, Perseverance in Life and Politics. And we're back with more right after this. What do you picture when you think of Illinois wildlife? Probably deer, raccoons, skunks come to mind. Surprise, you can add armadillo to that list. The shelled mammals have been working their way north from Texas for more than a century, and they have already been spotted in southern Illinois, and they reportedly have their sights set on the bright lights, big city of Chicago. Our Patty Wetley is joining us now to give us those details. Patty, so we tend to associate armadillos with places like Mexico, Texas.
Yes.
What are they doing in Illinois?
You know, ever since they arrived in Texas in roughly the 1850s, or what's now Texas, they have just continued to consistently, if slowly, move their way north. And a lot of that has to do with climate change. You know, this is an animal that doesn't hibernate, doesn't like the cold, digs for its food in the ground, but there's less and less snow cover, and the winters are getting warmer. So it's just kind of creeping up along with warmer winters.
Short legs, but they move quickly.
Yes.
Because there's some evidence that they may have migrated as close as Kankakee. What do we know about that?
Yeah, a scientist at the Field Museum a couple years ago took a sample of water, analyzed the environmental DNA within that water from the Kankakee River, and lo and behold, she was surprised to find an armadillo DNA sequence turned up. Just a smidge under what she would consider 100% confidence, but there was evidence of the armadillo there. So, you know, they're here.
They're here. More research to be done on that,
yes.
I'm sure. Another scientist that you spoke with at the Field Museum said,
yes,
armadillos could appear in Chicago within the next 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
How might their presence disrupt the local ecosystem?
Yeah, scientists are saying, you know, it's not a matter of if they show up, it's when. And the short answer is we don't know how they're going to affect the local ecosystem. That's why they're kind of trying to get a baseline now. And they're asking people in central and northern Illinois to report their sightings. So we want to know, what's the status of certain species of birds now, and then what happens when armadillos come along and maybe start disrupting the nests that they have on the ground? What if they start competing with raccoons for resources? They don't really have predators here that we know of, at least as long as jaguars stay south. So, you know, we don't really know. They're not supposed to be here. We don't know what their impact will be.
Okay, so it sounds like we should probably get used to seeing them once that,
yes,
time comes. What should,
yes,
we know about them?
Well, they're about the size of a cat. So if you see a giant armadillo online, which is about the size of me, that's not the ones that we're expecting here. The only species in North America is the nine-banded armadillo,
that we're
looking
at right
now. Which means it has these, like,
yep,
nine flexible bands, kind of like a bendy straw that allows it to bend, does not roll up into a complete ball. Only the three-banded do that. And mamas out there will be interested to know that they have four, identical quadruplets every time.
Every time they
reproduce, it's identical quadruplets.
Little armadillo babies.
Yes.
Okay, Patty Whiteley, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Patty's full story all about the armadillo babies, the ones that roll up into a ball, on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. The teenage years are full of firsts, perhaps driving for the first time, getting your first paycheck or your first kiss. But publishing your first book probably isn't on a lot of teenagers' list of accomplishments. But our next guest did just that. At 16 years old, Aiden Brands wrote his first book, exploring the year 2020 from a teenager's point of view. And Brands didn't stop there. He wrote his friends into the plot by starting his own publishing company. Joining us now with more are Aiden Brands, author and owner of Aiden Brands Books, and Yareed Zaidi, author of The Short Kid from Pakistan. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And congrats on things. You all have published books. I haven't published books, so you've got something on us.
I mean, it's really fun to do what we're doing, and I'm so glad we get to talk about it here.
Awesome. So you wrote your first novel, Aiden, at 16, 2020, from a teenager's POV. What made you want to write that?
Well, you know, back in 2020, I stayed up all night, and I was just kind of processing everything that was going on in the world, and I was drinking a lot of coffee, so I was kind of, like, really energetic, and I just randomly decided to open a Google document and just start writing what I was feeling and what people my age were going through, because at the time, there really wasn't a lot of people talking about the teenage perspective of everything that was happening in 2020, and we can both admit that was a crazy year. So I just wanted to do something kind of unique and put something out that I really wasn't seeing, and that was really what started it all, just from one crazy night.
How'd you go from, like, writing, getting it all out, you know, in that first crazy night to all of those thoughts becoming a book?
Well, I worked on it a little bit as the weeks and months passed, and I kind of formatted it to be more like a story instead of just like a giant rant. And I put the book out on my own in early 2021, and it took a little bit of time, and it was a process, you know, trying to figure out how to do all this stuff. But once I did, it was, like, really amazing, and I got such a good reception from people, especially at my school and in my community in Palatine, and it was just, like, a really crazy experience just to go through all of that.
Eventually, you got in some of your peers, like Yareed, sitting next to you, whose book, The Short Kid from Pakistan, you published. Yareed, tell us about your book. What's it about?
Yeah, The Short Kid from Pakistan is about the short kid who's a fictionalized character, but his story is my story, and it's being put on, and he experiences to learn a new language, move across the world, and just, like, follow new traditions, not used to your old traditions. Like, he's just learning everything new all at once, and it's a really good story, and I've had people who are not from Pakistan, but they said, they're immigrants, they said, I really relate to your story, because I went through the same thing.
What was it like, sort of telling your own personal story that way?
It was very nice. I feel like some of it I just needed to get off my chest, so that felt pretty good. But also, like, being able to share my story, which I don't see that much of in the media at all, about Pakistan being represented at all. So I feel like that is a really good opportunity for me to represent my country and my story.
Aiden, why was it important for you to start your own company? What did you think was missing in the publishing industry?
So I really wanted to just see more authentic stories be told, because you look in the mainstream publishers and they're not really doing what we're doing. And the whole subtitle of my book, the first one, Teenagers POV, I wanted to expand upon that idea. And I really realized, like, the world is just bigger than my point of view. And that's why I wanted to give someone like Yareed a chance to share his point of view of the world. And that's really kind of the whole idea, just showing a different perspective that people don't really see or they don't really hear. And doing that has been such an amazing honor, because we're able to tell these great stories that people are connecting with. And for example, if someone doesn't connect with what I write, that doesn't mean they can't connect with what Yareed's writing, or maybe even someone like Evelyn. We're just trying to do new things and push the limits, to be honest, and be unique and embrace our uniqueness.
And you've published six books, nine books, six authors,
something like that. We've done a bunch.
Okay.
A bunch.
More than you can count, yeah. which is great. Yareed, what would you say were some of the challenges with being a Pakistani author, and what did you feel like people didn't understand about your experience?
I believe some people definitely don't understand the tradition over there. Like, we have a lot of different traditions, like Ramadan, and there's a lot of other modes, like Eid, just like our holidays too. But like that people didn't understand, but also like what's it like living in a third world country with poverty and like just like a lot of bad stuff going around you that's out of your control.
Right. And like, also what it's like moving from that to this, to here,
yeah,
basically to this.
Yeah, moving across the globe, learning a new language, learning how to like have new manners, new
cultural
everything.
Cultural norms, yes.
Yeah, culture shock.
Yeah,
very much.
I'm sure. So according to the National Center for Education Statistics, there have been long-term declines in the share of 13-year-olds who reported reading for fun almost every day. In 2012, it was 27% of 13-year-olds, falling to 17% in 2020 and 15% in 2023. And, you know, we've got the two of you. You are currently community college students, but you started doing this when you were in high school. You know, what do you think needs to be done to encourage the younger generation to read more? Aiden, I'll start with you.
I think that we got to get our young people to read books that they want to read, that they can connect with, because I think sometimes in schools, you know, the students are kind of forced to read these books that they don't really want to read, or they can't really relate to it, and they can't connect with what's on the page. I think that's a big aspect of it. I think there's a lot of things that need to be done. I think it's an issue that's bigger than just me and you read. I think it's like, it's a group effort. A lot of people are going to have to come together and think of ways to raise those numbers, because it's honestly concerning. I encourage reading. I think everybody should read, no matter what your age is. I don't know, you read, you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I just agree with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's my point of view is the same.
Yeah. What's next for you, Yareed? Do you plan on, you're studying radiology right now. Do you plan on writing any more books?
Yeah, I actually have a new book coming out soon.
Is Aiden publishing that one for
you? Yep, Aiden is publishing it.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be called Apollo Darwin 2. Well, then the title's not fully out yet.
Okay.
It's a sequel to a book that he did called Apollo Darwin. And it's about a convicted felon getting out of jail and just trying to rebuild his life. And it kind of shows how society, it's hard for people who get out of the prison system to kind of move forward. And it's really...
Absolutely.
It's kind of different from what we do, but it still shows a POV that I think is super important.
Well, I look forward to reading it when that one is ready to go, because I was on the website. I read a couple of pages of some of them, and they were page-turners. I wanted to see the rest of it. We'll have to leave it there, though. Aiden Brands, Yareed Zaidi, thank you so much for joining us. Congrats.
Thank you for having
us.
Thank
you so much.
Weekends never seem to be long enough. Between the endless errands, social gatherings, and just getting some rest and relaxation. But while you're working to fit all that into your next weekend, there is one thing you better do on Saturday, and that is because you cannot buy a car of any kind in Illinois on Sundays. Our Nick Blumberg has the story in our latest edition of WTTW News Explains.
Ah, the weekend. The perfect time to knock a few items off the old to-do list. Run to the grocery store, make a trip to the hardware store. Buy a new car? Not so fast. Not on Sunday. Since the 1980s, it's been illegal for car dealerships to operate on Sundays in Illinois. Why? Well, some owners and employees wanted to shut down to spend time with their families or for religious reasons. But, and pay attention, this is the key. They didn't want their competitors to be open and have a chance to steal business. The first attempts to close down dealerships on Sundays date back to the 50s and 60s, but those laws never made it off the lot. They were vetoed or struck down in courts. But since 1984, Illinois car dealers must close their doors on Sundays. Illinois isn't alone. A dozen other states don't allow Sunday car sales either. It's a vestige of so-called blue laws barring certain activities on the basis of religion, like, say, buying a sports car on the Sabbath. The religious angle is one reason Illinois' ban has been challenged multiple times. One alternate proposal still restricted car sales to 6 days a week, but allowed dealerships to pick which day they take off, since, for example, Jews and Muslims don't observe a day of rest and prayer on Sundays. Some pro-business groups argue the law restricts free commerce, but so far, Illinois has kept the Sunday car sale ban on the books and would-be test drives off the roads. So, if you're looking for a hot deal on a new set of wheels, you'll have to look on another day.
And you can watch more in our WTTW News Explains series on our website. And that's our show for tonight. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm serving Chicago for 37 years.